In the early days of the coronavirus outbreak, state and national officials were willing to try anything, or almost anything, to get ahead of what was coming, a surge of cases and hospitalizations. And so you had people from different sectors of the economy asking to pitch in, build ventilators and make masks and do other things to speed up the glacial pace of medical science. Here in Utah, a group of Utah tech executives came up with an ambitious plan. They would use the principles of innovation and disruption to speed up the testing process. They'd create these drive-through testing sites in company parking lots and accelerate the system of processing tests. They called it Test Utah, and state officials signed on immediately. They said this would be a game changer. But not everyone was on board. Some infectious disease experts worried if you could or really should disrupt the delicate and precise process of testing someone for a deadly disease. Among those expressing concern was the director of Utah's public health lab, Robin Atkinson Dunn.
It was a Saturday afternoon. I had actually managed to take the day off, which was a rare occurrence during the COVID response. And I got a phone call from my boss.
Hello?
And I wasn't expecting to hear from her, so I thought, something's blowing up. And then when I finally connected with her, she asked if I was willing to meet with her and the deputy director for the Department of Health on Monday morning at 10 o'clock in person. I was asking questions about what was this meeting about? Can I have some agenda items? Radio silent. Needless to say, I didn't sleep much Sunday night. I woke up Monday and drove to the Cannon building, which is where they had asked me to meet. The deputy director was the first to arrive. And then my boss arrived, and then it was just the three of us in the room.
First on Fox 13, Utah's largest tech companies are joining the fight against COVID-19.
TestUtah.com is an open source version of healthcare aimed at testing everyone in the state.
Some experts worry that it may not be the best use of resources.
When did you notice something was wrong?
I think we all, as a department level, started having some questions. Maybe a week or two into Test Utah being live, their positivity rate was much, much lower than the other labs in the state. Most of the other labs were consistently day to day at around 5 to 6% positivity rate. And the Test Utah test results were always around 0.6%. So just on the face of that, you start to ask questions. And I had been pretty vocal about the laboratory that Test Utah had chosen to use. The lab wasn't performing to the standard that those of us in the laboratory community felt was necessary. And not only did I think it was unethical for the state to continue to utilize Test Utah's services, had documented evidence that they were not correctly validated their testing, I felt it was unethical for the state to continue to use them. And I had voiced that on several occasions. It wasn't a popular opinion. I had been told that my attitude was not collaborative, that I was being an obstructionist. I was speaking on behalf of my profession. I was speaking on behalf of my 15 years of experience in the field, that for proper public health actions, you needed proper test results. And the laboratory used by Test Utah was not providing valid test results.
What happened then?
I think my boss started the conversation by saying, this is a difficult conversation to have. You know how sometimes when you're getting bad news, things kind of go a little tunnel vision and a little quiet?
Move along. Move along.
that's sort of what was happening as she was talking, because it was becoming very clear that I was getting disciplined in some way. And then she said, we've made the decision to reassign you. She was looking at me for a response. And I distinctly remember just sitting there for what seemed like ages. I'm still trying to put this together. Like, what have I done? Why is this happening? And I just asked for that moment of clarification. Like, I'm being reassigned. And she said, yes. And I said, being reassigned to what? And that's when she told me I was being reassigned to an epidemiologist. And my immediate response to that was, I don't know how to be an epidemiologist. I'm hardcore lab science. That's what my education was about. That's what my training was about. That's what I spent the last 15 years of my career doing. Yet somehow it's okay that I can now be an epidemiologist. They gave me a document to sign. They told me that I was being placed on administrative leave. They took my laptop, my state phone. They told me I was not allowed to contact anyone at the lab, could not contact any clients or coworkers, wasn't allowed to speak on behalf of the Department of Health or the lab, and that I was to report to my new job the next Monday. It really honestly felt like I had been terminated. That feeling that I left there with, of just complete cut off, and to just sort of summarily be cast aside, it just hurt. It hurt.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about this Test Utah initiative. For now, it seems the state is committed to it, but there are questions, not only about the reliability and protocol of the tests, but the motives behind the idea. The Salt Lake Tribune has been investigating the story. So has the New Yorker magazine. Recently, the journalist Robert Baird reported a story for the New Yorker called How Utah's Tech Industry Tried to Disrupt Coronavirus Testing.
Well, I've been covering COVID-19 testing essentially since the beginning of the pandemic. Testing has been one of the major problems that we faced as a country in confronting the disease, because it's really hobbled our response, or at least not having enough testing has. And so, you know, I was tracking a number of different areas in which different types of laboratories were trying to get testing up and running. And one area that I hadn't covered that much was kind of commercial efforts to get testing ramped up. And so I talked to a few people, and a few of my sources had said, oh, you should take a look at what's happening out in Utah, where this group of, you know, technology companies tried to get a testing effort ramped up. And so initially I was kind of interested from that perspective, as just like what happens when a group of companies who want to do something for the country try to pull together a testing effort. But the more I looked into it, the more it became clear that there were some real issues with that approach.
What do you think if you were to sort of put them in a category, the beyond the just sort of qualitative issues and the fact that you've got a tech company that doesn't have any real experience doing something like this, trying to do something like this, is it about the idea of disruption? Is it about this idea of the sort of knee-jerk reaction, the sense of urgency that made, you know, government officials and people scramble to figure something out? What do you think the sort of overall theme is, if you think about this particular story?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a version of a story we've heard before, which is this attitude, which is by no means limited to the tech industry, but tends to be pretty common there, which is that we can come in and do something that other people can't do. We have some combination of talent and ingenuity and creativity that allows us to see around problems in a way that other people can't. And in a lot of cases, that actually proves to be true. You know, the tech industry has done a lot of great things in this country, but it's not a universal salvation for all problems that we face.
Yeah. So let's get into the particular idea. The idea behind Test Utah begins with this, as you lay it out, is this ambitious initiative by these Utah tech companies. Talk a little bit about what's inspiring the concept. I guess it's fueled in some ways by this idea of, you know, this disruption innovation idea.
Yeah, I think at the beginning, the companies involved here and the executives in these companies who were really driving the effort really were genuinely looking around and saying, this is a huge problem that we are facing. We meaning the country, we meaning Utah, we meaning our community in Utah County. How can we help? What can we do? Is there something that we can bring to the table? And in the earliest days, you know, the effort that became known as Test Utah started out as a sort of philanthropic effort. They were raising money to buy PPE. They were raising money to get medical supplies. And testing and, you know, to a lesser extent, treatment was also going to be part of that. They said, look, we have this company called Co-Diagnostics. It's right here in Utah. Nobody else knows about them. We have a kind of inside line on getting their tests. We can basically bring something to the table that's necessary right now. For all of that, that sounds great. The problem is that it very quickly became a sort of us versus them type attitude that developed, I think. They just didn't have a lot of patience for listening to what some people were trying to tell them about how difficult testing can be and how necessary some of the steps involved really are.
Do you think that represents a kind of theme in these stories where you have ambitious entrepreneurs who are trying to disrupt an industry and they're just not willing to? I mean, it seems like you look at, I know Theranos is an example that comes up a lot. It seems like the first thing that comes up, but, and I'm sure there's a continuum there of different versions of this kind of story. But is there a kind of a pattern here where you see people who are trying to do different things? They're just not willing, as you say, they're not willing to maybe listen to the experts in some ways.
Yeah. And look, I mean, to give them credit, like, it's very hard to be an entrepreneur, right? When you're starting out as an entrepreneur and you're starting a company, everybody in the world is telling you, we don't need this. There's already a MySpace. Why do we need a Facebook? You know, there's already a search engine. Why do we need Google? And so I think that that kind of attitude can serve people well in some circumstances. But I think the real question that we come to is, you know, is this the kind of attitude that we want in the middle of a crisis, in the middle of a pandemic, where there are real human lives at stake and not just, say, advertising dollars for a search engine?
Let's talk about what's motivating all of this beyond just the impulse to disrupt an industry and how much money comes into play in this. As far as you can tell, how much of this is just an act of, you know, altruism, responding to the moment, the emergency of COVID-19, or how much of this is them wanting to, these tech companies, sort of reveal their creativity and agility to do something at the moment? How much of this is an effort to just sort of find a market or an angle or money? So where, you know, how do you see all of that?
I think it really changes. I mean, it's hard to overstate how much things were changing on a day-to-day basis. Remember, we're in the middle of a global pandemic here. The lack of COVID-19 tests in this country was very quickly recognized as this huge problem that needed to be solved ASAP. I start the piece when Silicon Slopes announces that they're going to be doing this philanthropic effort. They're going to try and raise money for an effort of which testing will be a huge part. But in the various earliest email that Mark Newman, who's the CEO of Nomi Health, one of the companies that's centrally involved in all this, the very earliest email he sent to some of his colleagues basically said, like, look, let's get testing for our companies. And he actually proposed Tom's Shoes as a model. So he said, we'll provide testing for our employees and our families, and then we'll kind of do a one-for-one match with the community. That was on March 14th that he sent that email. 4 days later, when Silicon Slopes starts talking about this on their town hall, it's already become this philanthropic effort. They're going to use this new community fund to raise money. You know, it's really just 2.5 weeks after that that Test Utah launches. And by that point, they've signed contracts with the state of Utah. So it's become something else entirely altogether. So, you know, I think that there's an effort in retrospect to sort of shape it and say, oh, yes, well, this is what we wanted all along. But if you go through and watch, and you really can go through and watch because they have all of these town halls on video and they're still posted on YouTube, it really does change very quickly because things on the ground are changing pretty quickly.
Early on, one tech executive says, there's nothing else to read into this. There's no angle here. But explain how this really plays out and how they were talking to each other about the idea of whether they could make money or should be making money. You detail in the piece this Zoom conversation where this idea of no one making any profits starts to sort of transform and get clarified, I think is the word someone used.
Yeah. So at the launch of Test Utah on April 2nd, Clint Betts, who's the head of Silicon Slopes, which is a sort of tech booster organization, says, look, no tech companies are going to make any money on this. We're going to ensure that. And then the next day they have a Zoom call and Bet says, well, actually, you know, let's just talk to Mark Newman and let's clarify what I said. And Newman says very reasonably, look, to do the stuff that we're doing costs a lot of money. We have to pay for the tents. We have to pay for the nurses that we're going to hire. We have to pay for all these supplies, you know. And as I've learned in my reporting elsewhere, they also said, well, look, the state just got all this money from the CARES Act, from Congress. Why should this be a philanthropic effort? Which is all fine, but I think a lot of the questions were more about why this wasn't transparent in real time and why it kind of had to be walked back in the first place. Why not just say from the beginning, oh, look, we thought this was going to be a philanthropy, but in fact, we're now working with the state and we've got this money and this will allow us to build an even bigger program.
So tell us about the idea itself, those who are unfamiliar with the vision that they have for Test Utah, at least in theory. How does it seem? Because it seems like, you know, it's impressive. Get these tests, hire a small army of nurses to collect these specimens, develop this online tool, use local facilities to pull it all off.
Yeah. So the idea was they were going to build this online assessment tool, which in the ideal version, every person in the state would take. And this tool, with the help of an algorithm that was developed in coordination with the Utah Department of Health, would tell you whether or not you needed a COVID-19 test. And if it's decided that you did, then in that moment, the tool would help you schedule a test. And you could go to a Test Utah site. You could get a test. You could get swabbed. That information would come back to you, and it would also go back to the state. And then there would also be a component where the state had a sort of online crisis command center where they would be able to monitor hotspots throughout the state and watch and say, okay, we've got to watch out. There's a hotspot brewing in Park City or whatever, you know, or up in Cache County, whatever it's going to be. And they would be able to track that at the sort of macro level, which, again, all sounds great in the abstract. I think the problem was that they didn't recognize quite how much particular work it would take to get the tests up and running. And they didn't understand the details of why other people were having problems with testing. They just looked around and said, oh, look, the whole country is having trouble with testing, but we can sort of solve this. We've got a way through this. You know, Utah has one of the largest reference laboratories in the country in ARUP. They have people who are really experienced in diagnostic testing. There was a lot of expertise they could have drawn on, but they didn't do that. They kind of stuck to themselves and said, no, we're going to solve this. We can figure this out ourselves.
There was this, you mentioned this in the article. At first, there's this sense that Utah had enough capacity to do the tests. But then you have senior state government officials, Mark Newman, you mentioned, who really pushed back on this idea. Newman says, I'll be completely blunt. This is the quote. I'll be completely blunt, and I guess I'm sharing more from the perspective of the business community. I think this posture, this idea that we have enough tests and that there's no demand for them is complete BS, as he puts it. What's he getting at there? What's he saying?
There is a real live debate here, right? The question is basically how many tests does a state like Utah need?
Yeah.
And it doesn't have one easy answer. It sort of depends on what phase of the epidemic you're in. You know, what the state epidemiologist Angela Dunn had said at one point was, look, we now have enough testing. Basically, we have two times the number of tests we would need to test everybody with symptoms. Mm-hmm. And at that point, what the CDC and other people were saying was, we really need to focus on symptomatic people. I think for Newman, you know, especially for Newman and for some of his colleagues, they were in the back of their minds always kind of focused on, like, how do we get people back to work? We need to get people back to work. And in order to do that, he believed correctly that you need to really think about testing asymptomatic people and go much broader than that. So there's a kind of competition between what are you actually trying to do with these tests? And that really depends on, again, where you are in the pandemic, where you are on the epidemiological curves.
Who signs on to this idea? Utah, of course, gets on board, and then a few other states start getting interested in this.
That's right. So Utah signs up, and within the first month, both Iowa and Nebraska had also signed on. They signed larger and longer contracts. Each of those states signed contracts that were almost $27 million. They were going to offer 6 months worth of testing, and I believe it was a year's worth of the tech services that went along with it. Tennessee also signed a similar contract more recently, although I just learned in the week after my piece published that by mutual agreement, the companies in the state have unwound that contract in Tennessee.
And what reason is that? The same concerns that have been revealed.
I wish I could tell you, but I don't know.
Really?
That's all they'll tell me. Yeah.
So it seems like one of the things you mentioned in the piece is that these tech guys were pretty good at the marketing part, like pretty good at the coordinating part. Mm-hmm. But the quality of the operation part, that was the part that they didn't seem to have a handle on. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think that's right. As I was saying earlier, you know, they really thought that they had these tests from this small company called Co-Diagnostics. And as we're saying, Co-Diagnostics had never sold a test for clinical use in the United States before the COVID-19 pandemic hit. Yeah. They had sold clinical tests abroad, and they had sold some tests in the United States that were used for agriculture and for mosquito abatement. But they'd kind of taken a look at the regulatory hurdles in the United States and said, you know what, we're not ready for this. We don't want to do this. When the pandemic hit, the FDA said, we need more testing. And so they lowered the barriers for companies to provide testing. And that allowed Co-Diagnostics to offer its COVID-19 tests, which at that point it was already selling abroad, to the United States market.
So COVID-19 is changing the future, the prospects of this company.
Hugely.
Yeah.
Hugely. Yeah. You can look at their stock chart, you know, and back in January, their stock was trading at something around $1 a share, something like that. And that went up to $10, $15 as they were able to sell their test on the market in the United States. So this is really make or break for a lot of companies, and they're not alone in this. I mean, for a lot of companies, it may not have been a hugely lucrative market for some of these companies before, but then all of a sudden they actually have this technology that people need, and you know, they make use of it. What the Test Utah guys didn't really count on was that they needed a lot of other things to go along with these tests. So in the very earliest days, they didn't even realize that the test that Co-Diagnostics was selling didn't come with something called an extraction kit. And what an extraction kit is that is what you use once you have this swab. So I don't know if you've had a COVID-19 test, but it's a quite unpleasant process. They stick this long swab up your nose, feels like it's scratching your brain. They twirl it around a little bit and pull it out. That thing gets put in a tube and transported to the lab. And once it's at the lab, they use these extraction kits essentially to withdraw whatever viral RNA material may be on that swab and to prepare it to undergo the actual test part of the test. There can be some confusion because people talk about the test as if it's a single moment in time, but it really is this whole process, everything from swabbing to transport to extraction to using the actual assay, which is a technology called polymerase chain reaction or PCR. What Co-Diagnostics was selling was the PCR part of the process. And so the Test Utah guys didn't realize that they really needed this extraction piece to go with it. They thought that came with the test. As it happens, the extraction piece was something that everybody in the country and in many parts of the world was fighting over because there just weren't enough of them.
Yeah.
The diagnostic test industry is not set up to provide extraction kits at the scale that we needed. And so they really had to, you know, hunt around and try and figure out, okay, well, what are we going to do? They had the same problem with swabs. You know, they kind of went to the state and said, look, we're going to provide everything for you. We're going to give you 3,000 tests a day. It's going to be great. But then it turns out, just like everybody else, they couldn't get swabs. And so it was a lot of things like that, that like they sort of assumed like, oh, well, we can take care of this. No one has really thought about this angle before. But it turns out that this is a very well-developed industry and people had thought about this, you know, weeks before and were having the same kinds of issues.
So the problems start to reveal themselves right away, I guess.
They do, yeah. One of the biggest issues that they ended up having was, you know, they chose for the laboratory that was going to process their tests, the laboratory at a hospital called Timpanogos Regional Hospital in Orem, which had done diagnostic testing before, but it had not done diagnostic testing at anything like the scale that Test Utah was going to require. And so they had to scale up very quickly as well. And that also seems to have caused some problems for Test Utah. I mean, you know, one of the people I spoke to was now the former head of the Utah Public Health Laboratory, Robin Atkinson Dunn, and she went down to visit there. And at Timpanogos Regional Hospital, they had expanded their lab space into what had been a conference room. So as Dr. Atkinson Dunn explained it to me, there's a big conference table in the middle, there's chairs all around it, and there's carpet on the floor.
Yeah.
And she said for her, this was a huge red flag because labs just never have carpet. You just don't know what's going to be growing in them. You don't really know. You know, it's just the kind of thing that a person involved in diagnostic tests would never, ever do. And so there were things like that that really started to show up and people started to say, wait a second, what's going on here?
Well, you also mentioned sort of an old rickety desk that's there from the 1970s. They used Glad press and seal to close up their specimens. I don't want to overstate this and be unfair to the Timpanogos Regional Hospital, but there were some concerns by some about whether or not they could handle not just the scale, but this process as they were trying to figure it out.
You know, we definitely want to be fair, but it's also worth saying that federal regulators inspected the lab and came back with a 27-page report full of violations of federal regulations and, you know, listed some very key things that the lab was not doing. They were not keeping samples at the proper temperature. They were not properly tracking the specimens as they moved through the process. They were not doing the sorts of maintenance that they were, the regular maintenance that they were supposed to be doing on this extraction machine that they used. And, you know, potentially most concerning of all, they had not properly validated the extraction machine that they ended up settling on, which, you know, I'd explained to you that, that they were having trouble finding extraction kits. They ended up using a machine called an Octopure, which is a robotic extraction machine that's typically used for agricultural diagnostic testing. So, you know, you might want to be testing whether you have E. coli on your lettuce or that sort of thing.
Yeah.
There's no reason in principle that this thing couldn't work, you know, on human samples, but it hasn't been through the rigors of the FDA preclearance process. And for as far as I can tell, for at least 3 weeks, they had not done any of the sort of verification validation that the FDA recommended for this machine.
Well, it raises this question, this significant problem that you highlight in the in your reporting, and this is the proportion of positive tests in the Test Utah system. They're quite different from the average results from other labs. Talk about this part of the story.
Sure. So I should say, you know, again, to be fair, this showed up early on. This just showed up in the first couple of weeks of their operation. Yeah. But the state had a kind of informal testing task force, which involved a number of people who were involved at all these different labs who would meet regularly to talk about testing. And in the course of those meetings, it became clear that Test Utah's tests were producing only about 2% positives, whereas the other labs were showing all around 5% or even higher in their tests. So, you know, one day or 2 days, that might be just an anomaly, but this showed up over and over again. And people started to say, wait a second, what is happening here? This is a real problem. There was an email that one of the participants in that testing task force, Dr. Bert Lepanzri, sent around. He just said, this could be a real public health disaster. You know, we don't know, is there a problem with the co-diagnostics test? Is there a problem with the process? Is there something else going on? Now, everyone involved with Test Utah, and that includes, you know, both Mark Newman and his colleagues, it includes Timpanogos Regional Hospital, it also includes co-diagnostics, they all say this can be explained because in those early days, Test Utah was testing a higher proportion of asymptomatic patients.
Right.
So, you know, the Utah Public Health Laboratory, ARUP, Intermountain Health, they were all getting people who were much sicker, so they were naturally going to get a higher proportion of positives. We, because we were using this algorithm, the algorithm had a kind of looser standard of who could get a test, and so of course we're going to get a lower number of positives. It's certainly possible that that played a role, and it could have even played a significant role, but according to my reporting, you know, the differences between the positivity rates of Test Utah and these other labs, it persisted even once you controlled for symptomatic versus asymptomatic. There was a big report that the Salt Lake Tribune did on, which published on April 28th, and they've done a lot of great reporting on this, that was the first to really bring to light these positivity issues. And after that report, you know, in the days after that report, Test Utah's numbers started to go up and match what you were seeing in the rest of the state. They say that that's because they tightened their algorithm and made it match what the other labs were seeing. But, you know, these numbers have lots of different inputs. So I think it's really hard to tell exactly what would have caused these differences. And what you really need is you need a sort of controlled test just to see, are these tests, do they have what's called the same sensitivity as the other tests that other labs are using?
Would you say a little bit more about that? Because one of the things you write in the article is you say that a COVID-19 diagnostic test is not a momentary procedure. It's a process.
Yeah, so it's a process. And what that means is basically at any point in that chain or in that process, things can go wrong, right? So if you leave a sample out overnight at room temperature, that sample could degrade. So you're going to have less viral RNA. So you have a better chance that you're going to get a mistake in that process. As it turns out, by Timpanogos' own, by a study that Timpanogos did, it shows that the Octopure machine that they used for extraction actually increased something called the limit of detection for the co-diagnostics tests threefold. So it means that you need more virus in a sample to be able to get a positive test result back. And it raised it to a pretty high and pretty concerning level. You know, and again, like co-diagnostics and Timpanogos, they all say, well, look, this limit of detection thing is not that important. It's basically if you're sick with COVID-19, you're going to have a ton of virus in your body and our tests are going to pick it up. It's going to be fine. But other people I've spoken to say, no, you know, especially in the early days, if you're trying to catch somebody, say, right before they start to show symptoms or just as they're showing symptoms, you might not have that high amount of virus in your body. And so having a test that has a high limit of detection could miss some of those people. And that could be part of what's causing this differential in positivity rates.
Do you have a sense that the test Utah people, that they're adjusting to these problems, that they're fine-tuning the process, that it's working better? What's your sense of how it's evolving, given all of this concern about some of these things?
It's really hard to know. I mean, I wish I had more visibility into it. They have sent me some of their internal numbers that show that the positivity rates are matching what they're seeing with other laboratories. But again, you know, a lot of different factors can play into those numbers. So you really, I think at this point, there's enough questions that you really have to look at the tests themselves or the tests plus the extraction process that they're using. You can't judge from these population numbers to see what's going on. They say, and you know, the state says as well, that they still have confidence in the processes. Test Utah has confidence in Timpanogos. The state says they still have confidence in Test Utah.
Medical experts have been raising questions about this. One infectious disease expert expressed in an email something that was obtained by the Salt Lake Tribune that you mentioned in the article. And they expressed this: a pandemic is not the time for amateurs to learn. Is that part of what's going on here? Is that a sort of a bigger theme here, is that these guys just don't have the experience to pull this off?
I think so. Yeah, I think so. And they couldn't see, because they didn't have that experience, they couldn't see around the corner to see the problems they were about to have. They didn't know, they didn't recognize that they were going to need these extraction kits at the beginning. They didn't recognize that you can't just turn on a lab overnight and triple its output and say all of a sudden you're handling, you know, 3,000 tests a day when previously you've been doing 17,000 tests a month. That's the kind of thing that I think an experienced, you know, laboratory scientist could say, well, wait a second, we're going to have to slow down here. We have to make sure that we've got space for our machines. We've got to make sure that these machines are validated. Has this Octopure extractor ever been used before? Do we have any evidence that it's going to work in the way we need it to work? Okay, well, if not, then we need to be really careful and make sure that it's going to give us results that are consistent with what we expect. And that was the kind of stuff that seems to have occurred to them, you know, belatedly at best, I would say. I actually give a lot of latitude for people who are trying to make things work. And I don't think that it's easy. And I think that we have to understand that in the midst of a pandemic, you might not be able to do everything exactly as well as you might like to do it in normal times. Nevertheless, what you're dealing with here is really people's health. And, you know, that was something that Dr. Atkinson Dunn brought back to me. It was like, this is not just an abstract question of red tape and regulations and proper procedure. This is really, can a person who gets a COVID-19 test trust the result that they're getting? Mm-hmm. You know, the example she brought up to me was, say you're starting to have sort of mild symptoms and you want to see, like, is this just a cold or is this COVID-19? I want to go see my grandmother who's in her 90s. You go and get a test. The test says you're negative. Can you trust that result? Or are you risking bringing this disease to somebody who could really suffer much worse than you might from it? And so that's where it's a real, you know, competition of priorities here.
Yeah. Can those samples be trusted right now, as far as you can tell, this part in the process? They had problems at the beginning. They're fine-tuning. They're working it out. Can they be tested, these samples, right now, as far as you can tell in your reporting?
I wouldn't trust them, to be honest. I mean, it's not to say they're definitely going to be wrong. It's just to say that we don't know. There were enough problems that the federal regulators turned up that I think there are some real issues at the lab that need to be addressed. And I think this question of whether the co-diagnostics tests in combination with this Octopure extractor are producing the kinds of results that people want to see is still a live one. It has not been answered sufficiently.
I guess finally, I come back to something you were talking about earlier, this idea that, and this is what the health department has said, is they said, look, this program, we're in the middle of a crisis. We were trying something that we figured could meet this crucial need. And I guess it goes back to that. We're probably, since we're still in the midst of this, it's too early to see or say which of these experiments are working, which of them aren't, which might be frauds, which might be incompetence. There's just going to be a lot of experimenting going on, I guess, at this point.
That's right. But I think that once that coronavirus testing task force started to see the difference in the numbers, you know, along the lines of Dr. Lapandre's email, like, that's the point to say, okay, wait a second, let's stop, let's figure out if there's an issue here. Let's figure out if there's some problem. That's not the point where you say, like, full speed ahead, let's just keep going and you know, sort of damn the torpedoes. I think that there was and there is enough cause for concern that this really deserves a careful look, you know, at the science, and it needs controlled studies, and it needs somebody to say, like, is this lab up to snuff? Are these tests plus this extractor up to snuff? Are we getting the kind of results that we expect? As you say, there are lots of tests out there. There are probably going to turn out to be a whole bunch of them that are not very good. We've already seen that on the antibody testing side. There's just a whole bunch of antibody tests that people were using that turned out not to be very good and not very useful. It's kind of a Wild West situation that we have. That certainly could be the case on the diagnostic side too, on the PCR side. But, you know, if you're going to say this is going to be a major part of the way that a state like Utah is going to respond to the pandemic, you need to be able to give people faith in their results. It may not be perfect, but you need to give them faith that this is the best that you can be doing at any given moment.
Robert Baird, he's a freelance writer and editor. His article for The New Yorker is called How Utah's Tech Industry Tried to Disrupt Coronavirus Testing. It's available on the magazine's website. We have a link to it on ours, radiowest.org. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
With KUER's mobile app, you can listen to our live programming stream and all of our station's services. Catch up with local stories from KUER News and enjoy KUER podcasts like Radio West. You'll also find our uninterrupted streams of BBC World Service and classical music. The KUER mobile app is available for free on Apple and Android devices. Download it wherever you get your apps.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. We've been talking about the COVID-19 testing initiative called Test Utah, conceived by a group of Utah tech executives as a public-private partnership, although there have been questions now about their process and the results, not to mention conflicts of interest. So we reached out this week to some of the organizations involved in this story. The Utah Health Department declined our invitation for an interview. The lieutenant governor couldn't join us this week. We also reached out to some of the companies who conceived of Test Utah. We had an interview scheduled with Mark Newman of Nomi Health, but he eventually withdrew. They did send us a lengthy statement, and we'll put that on our website. Let me read some of it here. This is from, again, Mark Newman. He writes, "With COVID cases spiking across our communities, we're focused on one thing, working with the state to increase access to free testing for anyone who qualifies. We'd be more than happy to join KUER to talk about why community testing is so important to getting Utah back on its feet and how our programs streamline the testing process for patients, but now is not the time to rehash old articles." Newman also said in the statement, "The reality is our labs, our tests, our standards, and everything else we do all pass the rigorous standards set by the FDA, federal regulators, and the states in which we work." We'll get to a few more particulars in that statement here in a moment. The Salt Lake Tribune has been investigating the story. Reporters Bethany Rogers, Nate Carlisle, and Aaron Alberty. Earlier today, Alberty joined us, and we began with this question, the question of intent. Was Test Utah just a philanthropic effort, or is it more complicated?
You know, I can't read the minds of the people involved. We have obtained the emails that were circulating around the tech sector, as well as between the tech sector and public officials in the early days of this. And they are describing, let's fix it. Let's refund everything. We're going to get a testing system lined up. We're going to get treatments lined up, and we'll cover it. It'll be great for the public. We can get back to work. However, that language of we're not making any money off of this continued publicly even after contracts had been signed. So, you know, it's just hard to say what the plan was.
Let me ask you, generally speaking, you have reported that, for example, there was no state health department official present at the news conference here. You've also reported that some Zoom invitations showed that there were only, in one particular case, I think, only two public health officials invited to these group meetings. While there were at least 20 others invited, there were tech executives and legislators and an insurance company and a lobbyist. And so I guess to the question of who's really promoting this in the early days, who's really involved in the early days, because you get a sense that there are political figures and economic advisors and not as many healthcare experts. Is that accurate or fair to say?
There were two public health officials that were involved in these exchanges in sort of the genesis of Test Utah. That said, their epidemiologist, you know, wasn't involved, and at some points along the way was pushing back on some of the things that were happening. And we can see from the emails that were being sent between various state officials that, for example, Kristen Cox, one of the economic advisors for Herbert, mm-hmm. is adamantly arguing for Test Utah's version where people just sign up and get their test and anybody can do it, and is very frustrated with the health department for not agreeing with her yeah. on that and not agreeing with Test Utah on that. And for a while, it seems that that was what prevailed. It did take a while for that to get changed.
Let's get to the hydroxychloroquine part of the story. We now know, of course, that this anti-malarial drug is not a proper treatment for COVID. But talk a little bit about the connection you discovered between Test Utah and this effort by the state to buy a stockpile of the drug. Because you say that even though Test Utah has said that there isn't a connection as much, or it's not as strong a connection, you said they were intertwined right from the beginning.
Yeah, Mark Newman, the CEO of NOMI, his very first emails proposing this whole idea to the tech sector refer to getting and distributing drug packs of hydroxychloroquine and chloroquine zinc, and specifically getting them from a pharmacy in Draper. Now, that Draper pharmacy, Meds in Motion, ended up getting an $800,000 contract with the state later that month to provide hydroxychloroquine. And the legislature was even looking at spending another $8 million, though both of those deals ended up falling apart after the FDA's findings that it wasn't a safe or useful treatment for coronavirus. Now, it turns out that Mark Newman, who was pushing this Draper pharmacy and this treatment, he owns NOMI, got all the contracts to run Test Utah. He also sits on the board of directors of that Draper pharmacy, Meds in Motion. And during that time, like as the state is making that purchase, Newman is the one sending the invoice for the drugs to the state. And we see a number of questions about hydroxychloroquine appear, well, at least in the early days, on the Test Utah online form that's used to screen patients for testing. Questions about, are you allergic to hydroxychloroquine? Do you have all these various health conditions that don't have anything to do with coronavirus, but do have to do with a person's suitability for hydroxychloroquine? And at the same time, we have two occupational therapists that are in a lot of contact with some powerful legislators and some health officials, and they're pushing hydroxychloroquine hard. One of them describes it as a Lazarus cure in a press conference. And it turns out that those doctors, those occupational health specialists, were executives of this software company, SafeLane Health, which developed Test Utah's questionnaire. And that went on, you know, throughout the month of March, kind of in both on the Test Utah side, and these two guys who are also involved with Test Utah are pushing hard for hydroxychloroquine. We see lots of back and forth about how great it is. There was a big push for a standing order to dispense this drug without a doctor's prescription. And they tried to get a liability waiver too. And we can see the economic officials weighing in on this as well, saying, you know, we want to offer this to patients when they learn that they are positive. So this, you know, tying hydroxychloroquine distribution to Test Utah and testing availability was all kind of part of the architecture of this whole thing.
We've heard from Mark Newman of NOMI Health this morning, as we explained earlier on the program. One of the things that that he mentions in a statement provided to us is that Test Utah tests are FDA authorized. Test Utah patient data is 100% HIPAA protected. The Test Utah lab has been validated. Health experts in the FDA, according to their statement, are all confident in the co-diagnostics tests. There have been these more than four third-party validations of them. What can you say about the reliability of the tests. Clearly, Nomi Health, he's Mark Newman's, as you said, one of the principals in this Test Utah initiative, is saying it's all safe. It's all been authorized.
Well, you know, it has been authorized. I think it's important to note that when COVID-19 was spreading, the FDA applied a different standard of review to pretty much everything that has to do with coronavirus. So what they have is emergency use authorization, which doesn't involve the same level of review that a diagnostic product like this would normally go through. And there are a number of other tests that have this same level of authorization. And so, you know, you can see what, you know, how sensitive each test is. And the test that Test Utah is using, the co-diagnostics one, it's not the least sensitive, but it's in like the bottom fifth or so in terms of the sensitivity that they are saying, you know, on the packaging. That's what the manufacturer represents. Now, labs are supposed to run their own validations or their own tests to verify, their own experiments to verify the tests that they're using. And one of the things that came up when federal regulators inspected the lab that Test Utah is using is they began using this machine to automate part of the process, but then didn't do that experiment that's like standard to see how that worked alongside this co-diagnostics test. Meanwhile, ARUP labs in Salt Lake City and Intermountain and the health department had gotten together and planned proficiency challenge. That's the way that labs sort of test each other's accuracy and precision for tests. It's a normal process, and Test Utah refused to participate in that. So because we were getting data that showed that Test Utah's results, even for people with symptoms, were less than half of what the rest of the state was getting for people with symptoms in terms of positive results, the state wanted to confirm, you know, to some extent, how their test performed. And so they set up a much more rudimentary version of what ARUP tried to do called a sample comparison, where they just run a group of samples, send the samples over to Test Utah, let them run it and compare results. And then the trade also goes the other way, so the hospital can send them to the state as well. And so they set this up. We were told about it for weeks. We were asking for the results. Oh, well, they're being analyzed now. Oh, now it's over. The corporate owner of the hospital is reviewing the results. They have another week. So finally, you know, a couple of few weeks after that's been done, we're hearing, okay, the final draft is finally finished. It's on the director's desk waiting for approval. And that day, the director says, I'm not going to release these results because there was a problem with the samples. Hmm. We see in subsequent correspondence between the hospital's attorney and the health department that, yeah, there was a problem with one of the batches of samples, but then the health department sent over another one. So it appears that they corrected it, and yet we're still not allowed to see the results.
Let me ask you this finally. One of the things we heard from Nomi this morning from Mark Newman is, I'll read this from the statement, our contract has been extended in Utah. We're increasing our testing capacity every day. To imply anything else is misleading to the public and dangerous. Say something about the extension of the contract now. What's happening now? The state has extended the contract, and this is all going on, of course, at a time when the case count in Utah is spiking again, is increasing, and kind of alarming numbers. So say something about that. Seems like the state is what? They're still in on Test Utah for now, at least.
For now. So the state put out a request for proposals for any other vendors that want to enter a competitive bidding process, which was bypassed the first time around and the second time around. They put that out, you know, very shortly before Nomi's contract was set to expire. So because they said they put it out that late in the game, they didn't have an opportunity to run an entire RFP process and find and do the competitive bidding process in time. So they extended NOMI's contract until mid-July. Mm-hmm. Now, it does have the caveat that if federal regulators do decertify the lab that they're using, that nullifies the contract. But at this point, NOMI has billed the state more than $7.6 million, and this new contract is for at least another $2.6 million.
Erin Alliberty of the Salt Lake Tribune. We'll put a link to the Tribune's reporting on all of this on our website, RadioWest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. Our intern is Natu Twe, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Thank you.